why, if Harry Carey were alive today and broadcasting the World Series,
you wouldn't believe it. Hey, listen to this. Dirk of UFODigest.com received an email, I believe Saturday. It was supposed to be from Stan Fulham. And Stan was predicting that a fleet of UFOs would circle first the World Series stadium and then land, and then the ETs would come out and start shaking hands with the baseball players. Stan says the email is bogus. He never sent it. He never made a prediction like that. Stan, a lot of people have been trying to discredit you since this book came out. I mean, they even made up a fake Facebook page on you. The name of the book by Stan Fulham is Challenges of Changes. To say the least, evidently, Stan, this book is controversial. You were an officer with NORAD at one time. We have Stan Fulham on the line now from his home in Canada. Stan, welcome to the show. And I assume the book is doing pretty well.
It's doing extremely well. The reaction that we've received in the last several days was very much beyond our expectations.
Stan, before we start talking about your book, let's give our listeners a little bit of background about you. You go back to World War II, and that was when you first had your experiences, I believe.
You see, I was in the Air Force during the war and served in Bomber Command, in which I first experienced a UFO. But I was discharged in 1946, and then I traveled around the world, went to university, all this sort of thing, and then I returned to the permanent Air Force several years later. And when I returned, I was no longer a flyer. I was known as a fighter controller in NORAD, because your listeners have got to understand is that when the jet fighters take off against a supposedly enemy attack, these enemy bombers, it's usually at night, and they're not seeing. They don't know where they are, so where would the jet fighters go? They've got to be controlled towards in the direction of the bombers. That's what NORAD does. That's what the fighter controllers do, and we are trained to do that. I was trained at Tyndall Air Force Base, and later on, the more advanced training was at Yuma. And we would pick up these fighter sections, like Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and so forth, and we would direct them towards the enemy bomber. And when they got within, well, at that time, it was around 30 miles off the bomber, if they picked them up on their own radar, then they would take over and would go in for the attack. That's what fighter controllers did. In addition there, too, of course, we monitored the skies 24 hours a day, and we plotted the any aircraft that was tracked by our radar would be plotted on these huge boards, plastic boards. I think you have some idea what those things like. You very often see them in the movies and that type of thing.
Right, right.
Well, that's basically what it was. Now, when I was working in, then I'm working in NORAD. Now, one thing I want to make clear about this, Jerry, that NORAD is not a military organization. NORAD is a defense system. Now, it's operated and administered jointly by the USAF, by the United States Air Force, and the Canadian Air Force. And it has been that way right from the very start because it's a continental defense. So I was an officer in the Canadian Air Force, but I worked in the NORAD defense system, and the same with the USAF people. So anyway, one night, part of my job was also to act as the duty controller. So I'd go and sit in the radar base there, and we'd track these aircraft and identify which ones they were. If there were any unidentified aircraft traveling, it depended upon the circumstances, how fast they traveled, where they were going. We would scramble jet fighters to go out then to see what was going on. On this particular night, I reported for duty, and the man I was reporting, the officer I was replacing, told me, he says, there are two UFOs. This is at midnight. And they are anchored about 2-3 miles away at the end of the base. There was an air base there, right next to the radar.
And, Stan, what is the name of that Air Force
base? Yeah, that was Comox Air Base on Comox on Vancouver Island. Yeah. So I come in, and I checked the situation. And they hadn't been reported to NORAD as unknowns, which they should have been, but because it had been sitting there for about 2 hours. However, I decided that I had to do something about them, and so I scrambled two of the standby jets from the squadron, and they took off, and no sooner had they taken off than the UFOs disappeared very rapidly and flew south down and anchored out over the Pacific Ocean several miles west of Vancouver. Minutes later, when our jet fighters arrived in their proximity, they disappeared over the Pacific Ocean. Now, they and the jet fighters, I returned them back to base. Now, the next morning, I filed my report. Next morning, the base commander called, and he says, the media are calling from Vancouver, Seattle, Victoria. It's about some strange lights that were seen in the sky last night. But as you know, there was nothing unusual that happened last night. So there's no reason for us to be speaking to the media. And I understood, the squadron commander, of course, I'm talking about the radar-based squadron commander, understood exactly what the message was. Keep your mouth shut. You don't talk about these things. And so I would like to, Jerry, just explain what why this was, at least as far as I know.
Okay.
About 2-3 weeks later, NORAD called for a meeting with the squadron commander, the technical officer, and myself to discuss this particular incident. I was a bit apprehensive about that because I thought that maybe, you know, we normally think is that we've done something wrong, but they said, no, everything was fine, except that they're trying to refine their reporting process. They wanted to know more about how the spacecraft flew, about the lights, the different kind of lights, you know, all this sort of thing, and especially about their airworthiness. So I that was fine. We discussed it at length, and then later that evening, I sat in the bar with one of the officers, or a major of the intelligence officer with NORAD, and we had a long discussion about these things, and I told him about what the base commander had said, and he said, yeah. He says, there is a general agreement signed. It says it goes way back to 1956, and he had seen the document signed between the United States and Canada. He says, regulating and the information relating to the UFO phenomena. And he said there were no signatures. And he showed me the document. I saw the document. There were no signatures to it, which is rather strange. But about this, I find it rather interesting is that about 2-3 years ago, I was talking to Paul Elyer. Now, Paul Elyer in Canada was the former Minister of National Defense. And I told him about this particular incident, and he said he found it very strange. He says that he, as the minister, had never heard of it. He had never signed the document. The Prime Minister had never signed the document. And so I mentioned that to Dave, my good friend, the NORAD intelligence officer, earlier on we had discussed it. And he said, well, it won't be the first time that some of these documents, agreements, are signed at the military level and the politicians are not involved. I was quite surprised about that. Now, I can't confirm that this was the situation in this particular case. All I'm saying is that seemed to be the policy in North America for the control of information relating to reporting of UFOs. Well, look what happened to the commercial airlines. Of course, I don't know how old you are, but I'm thinking of going way back to the 50s and 60s, Jerry, and I can remember when the commercial airline pilots would report seeing UFOs, and it didn't take long before the airline companies could call in the pilots and tell them, you just keep quiet about this. You don't talk about these things because you're creating some sort of doubt in the public eye about our credibility and our professionalism, this sort of thing. So no more discussion about UFOs. Mm-hmm. So there was no more discussion. And the same thing with our pilots. They were military pilots. You don't discuss these things.
Stan, I want to be clear about the meeting. Who was it with?
Yes, well, that was with the NORAD people.
Mm-hmm.
NORAD intelligence, rather. And so we had a very good meeting, and we understood what they were doing is refining the reporting process to have it standard. Because, you see, the thing is, in those days, NORAD knew all about the UFO cabal in Area 51. They knew all about them. In fact, three of the officers, including, I think, my friend Dave, had been there on a visit, so they were well aware of it. However, is that the Air Force did not know everything about the UFOs. They knew about the Berties. The Berties are what we call the grays, the ones that have these very large bald heads and the black almond-shaped eyes with no ears and a slit for the mouth, about 3.5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
We very often see them in our movies and that type of thing.
Right,
now,
right.
The Berties had been one that crashed, and the American Air Force had retrieved the spacecraft like they did to Roswell, and they had bodies and this sort of thing. So they were well aware of the Berties. And besides that, they had communicated with the Berties, now going back, way back, for years. People are not aware.
Are you saying before 1947?
Yes, even before 1939, going back to the 1930s. Because, you see, the Berties are the ones who do the abductions.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else. There are no other aliens that do that. Now, I inquired from my principal source, the transcenders, just what was that situation? Why was that? Why were they doing these abductions? Apparently, the Berties, their little grays, are very brilliant. They have a very high intellect. In fact, they once mentioned to me, the transcenders mentioned to me that Eisenhower would have problems in their kindergarten. And they had cloned their bodies continuously over a period of thousands of years because they were brilliant, but they thought they could also live forever to be somewhat like gods. But God has universal laws, and one of them is the universal principle of diversity, that nobody, no being in the universe lives forever. They may live for thousands of years, some of them, but they will eventually die and cross over back to the spiritual world. So, anyway, but they cloned themselves to one day. They found out they no longer could reproduce. Their bodies could not reproduce other beings, other Berties.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are now on their last generation, although they live for about several hundred years. But they're on their last generation. And so what they did, they approached the Alien Council because they are a member of the Alien Council of Eight. That's the Pleiadians, the Alpha Centaurians, the Berties, the Orions, the Sirians, the Compsolites, the Pozzettis, Zeta Reticulis, and the Compsolites. And they begged the Alien Council for approval to abduct humans because our DNA was quite similar to theirs, and they were hoping to resolve their medical problem through these medical research. Not everybody at the Alien Council agreed to that. The Pleiadians especially, who happened to be our friends and protectors, were very, very much against it. But I suppose in compassion, the Alien Council said, okay, fine, under certain conditions, we will allow you to do that. And they've been doing this now for quite a long time. So that's the reason why they do these abductions. They're still doing it, by the way, but not as much as they used to, because they refined their medical research process. Like at one time, they very often captured humans and brought them up in their spacecraft and did their experiments there, and then they would release them back on Earth. But now they very seldom do that because they have these technologies which they install in the human being, and they can monitor from above just what the information they want to have.
So you're talking about implants.
Yeah. Now, but years ago, they started to do an interbreeding process. And so they captured abducted quite a number of humans, brought them to the Berties planet, and there they built...
And what's that name of this species again?
Berties, B-O-O-T-E.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Where are they from? Another star system?
No, well, that's the star system, Berties.
Okay.
It's a German name,
okay,
for the star system. We call them Berties. They don't call themselves that. That's the name we give them.
Okay.
But anyway, the thing is that, so they abducted. When I asked the transgenders about a year ago before I published the third edition, I says, well, how many people are there in this internment camp on Berties? This internment camp, by the way, is quite comfortable. They have it's under a dome where they have an atmosphere similar to one on Earth. They allow them to grow their own foods, and they intermix because they come from all different parts of the world, and, but they socialize and this sort of thing. But also there's a subject of all of these experiments, these medical experiments, and crossbreeding. They said there were 31,000, I think, 162 humans in that internment camp.
Wow.
Yes. And many have died there. So it is not exactly a very nice thing for human beings to experience. And people who have been abducted have gone through some pretty terrifying psychopathic experiences.
How about you, Stan? Have you been abducted?
No.
Okay.
No. I've read a great deal. I read, I think I read all the books about, especially Dr. John Mack's books, about abductees, and of course, the transgenders, not me, because I can't confirm it or deny it, but the transgender spiritual group, my principal sewers, you know, they confirm all of this.
I am interested in the transcenders, Stan. How did you become involved with this spiritual group?
Well, when I went back to the Air Force, well, first let's go back to World War II.
Okay.
I was in the prison camp in Poland, Allied 357. It was a prison camp for Allied airmen, or British airmen, American and Canadian. One hot July day in 1944, somebody ran into the hut and said, there's a rocket in the sky above. And we all ran out, we looked up, and there it was. It was this large red rocket flying from east to west at considerable height and at a great speed. It made no sound, and it had no wings. Now, we're all experts in aircraft recognition. We had to be in order to survive in aerial fights and that sort of thing. And we knew that this was no ordinary aircraft, but we didn't know what it was. And so we assumed, because the Germans had the V-1 and V-2 rockets, that it must be a German rocket, until somebody confounded the situation when he said, well, yeah, but it's flying from east to west, not from west to east. And we were in Poland, so obviously it must come from Russia. And Russia had no such technology. We soon forgot about it, you know, Jerry. We discussed it a bit, but we soon forgot about it because no one ever thought for one moment, it wasn't in our concept that this thing could be an alien phenomenon of any kind or an alien spacecraft. That was not the concept in World War II. I talked to fighter pilots who had experience with Foo Fighters. You know what Foo Fighters?
Yes, yes, of course.
Yeah, and they were telling me about their experience there. And again, never did they ever think is that it would be an alien vehicle or device of any kind. It wasn't until, I think, Donald Keogh's experience with flying saucers, what was in 1947,
mm-hmm.
then the military started to take a look at this and differently and realize that perhaps they could be an alien phenomenon. That's when I became convinced that's what we had seen. We had seen a UFO. Now, then, of course, when I went back to the Air Force and I had my experience with those UFOs, one thing and another, but I still didn't know who they were, where were they from, why were they here, why the abductions, are they a threat? I still didn't have those answers. And Dave, my good friend, the NORAD intelligence officer, who had a great deal of information about the UFO phenomena, he didn't know either. He knew something about the Berties, of course, and this sort of thing. And Nora had a lot of experience, in interactions and encounters with UFOs. Well, my experience was not unique. That happens and is still happening all across North America. So there's nothing unique about it. But who were they? Where were they here? Are they a threat? And the thing, I was talking to a very spiritual person one day, and I was telling her about my experiences with UFOs. And I said, you know, we track them on the radar. They appear. They disappear. They appear, disappear instantly. And then I told my friend about some fighter pilots I talked to. He said, we're chasing a UFO in the mountains of British Columbia. And this UFO disappeared into the side of a mountain, flying at a tremendous speed, There was no crash. There was no explosion. And then a few moments later, it appeared out of the top of the mountain, hovered for a minute, and then flew away totally unscathed. I talked to a commercial airline flying from Europe to the United States, and he was telling me he had the same experience. He witnessed a UFO dive into the ocean at tremendous speed and reappear several miles further completely unscathed. Now, that completely violates all of our known physical laws, that third-dimensional physical laws. That is impossible. Any craft that would crash into a mountainside would certainly disintegrate. So that raised my question about what's happening here. Obviously, they can disappear, however they do it, into another dimension, I suppose, and then reappear instantly. And I said, I've talked to scientists. I've talked to different scientists here in the United States. I've read every UFO book. There are no answers about that. And so she said, no. There are no answers on Earth. You'll have to get your answers from the aliens themselves, if you can. And so that means going to the fourth dimension. Or you can get your answers from the spiritual world in the fourth dimension. And she's recommended me to a channeler, Rick Thurston, who lives here in Canada. And he channels for the Transcender Group, a group of souls, about 43,000 souls, who worked as one mind and provide information for us. Well, I hesitated to do that, but I was so desperate for that information that one day I did contact Rick, and I made contact, and I discussed with the Transcender for about half an hour. And I tell you, Jerry, that experience was quite a shocker, because I realized there was nothing about me that they did not know. How could they possibly know this? We had never met. They were in the spiritual realm. I'm down on Earth. But anyway, that was the beginning of my experience.
Stan, how long have you been in contact with this group through your channeler?
Say 11, 12 years, every month, sometimes twice a month.
How does it actually work with this group? I mean, you said there were thousands of souls all tied together. Is it kind of like a group thing? I mean, common denominator? I guess collective consciousness?
I think that's very, very important, because, you see, I find with people I talk to, they have a great deal of hesitation about this, because, you know, they're born and raised within the Christian beliefs of that you live your life, and then when you die, nobody dies, but according to them, when you die, you go up to the spiritual world, and you go in judgment before God, and then you're either given a harp or you're given a shovel. Or with the other group, then you'll have eternal sex. Well, that's not the way it is at all. There's no such thing. And when you cross over, you're going back home, where we've lived for millions and millions and millions of years, some of us for billions of years. And that is our home. Where we are here on Earth is only a very temporary thing, and where we come to gain experience.
Stan, does this apply to other places, not just Earth? I mean, is this a universal truth? Does it apply to everyone in the universe?
Everything. Yeah. Well, there's nobody, like of all, there are some civilizations out there, planetary civilizations out there, that they are so vastly beyond us in spiritualism. They all have a spiritualism. I would like to make this comment about this. One time there was a discussion about this particular matter about, well, you know, that we have our atheists who don't believe in this sort of thing, and there's no God, and how it all came about, of course, in the Big Bang. And I believe it was the Transcenders who were asked about that. If not, it was somebody else, and it was in the spirit world. And their reply is, there are no atheists in the universe. They only exist on Earth. And I thought that was a very relevant answer.
Strange.
All the Pleiadians, the Byrtes, the Syrians, all of these alien societies, civilizations vastly beyond ours in technology and spiritualism, all believe in God. They know there's God created this vast universe, the spiritual kingdom. And it is mysterious beyond our wildest imagination.
I wonder why we here on Earth are different from the rest of the universe in this belief. I mean,
that's a good question, Jerry. military? That's a good question. I just dealt with that last night. And we're going to divert here for a minute, if you don't mind, Jerry.
Sure.
Okay. About that particular matter. Now, the transgenders told me in one of our discussions that one of the biggest threats facing mankind, well, earth changes, you know, earthquakes, tsunamis, this sort of thing, is a very serious challenge to mankind, but it will not destroy mankind, will not destroy the earth. It's going to start taking place maybe this fall, this winter, and up to 2012, and then it gets even worse. But it will not destroy the earth. Now, the world will be facing an economic and financial collapse. That will not destroy the world. International terrorism is growing. Al-Qaeda has a dirty nuclear bomb, and they have weapons of mass destruction. They have it today. That is a worrisome thing. But that will not destroy the world. But our environmental crisis, our pollution of our atmosphere will. And the CO2 now in our atmosphere is around at 9% average worldwide, worse in China, of course, increasing at 1% annually with our industrialization and the gross number of influx of cars and all this sort of thing. And of course, the increase in population, that doesn't help. The deforestation, all this sort of thing. So all of this is speeding up the process. Then, but it's increasing 1% a year, but the critical mass in which humans cannot survive in an atmosphere is 22% of CO2. And we're increasing at 1% a year, we're now at 9%. So you can figure for yourself. So I asked the transgenders about this. In fact, I've discussed it with them on many occasions. And they told me there are countless thousands of alien societies who have polluted their environment to total extinction. Not a single being, not a planet, not a plant, not an animal survived. Total extinction, countless thousands, maybe in the millions, over, you know, what I'm talking about, over throughout the our history. And then, here about a year ago, the Alien Council, consisting of those eight planetary systems I told you about, they form into a council. They meet regularly, about every month. They discuss Earth because they monitor us regularly. And they decided at that meeting, especially through the prodding of the Pleiadians, who are sort of our guardians type of thing, that they should do something about, they should intervene to clean up our atmosphere, otherwise we're on that path of destruction. And it wasn't an easy, pitch, but finally the Asian Council agreed, yes, they would intervene. Now, that was about a year ago. But they were afraid if suddenly they appeared over Earth, thousands or hundreds of their UFOs, it would create massive fear and panic and confusion. And they were afraid is that they would be viewed as a threat and they would not be able to interact with mankind. So they decided what they would do. They would intervene one step at a time. They would first fly over, I have a UFO display over our principal cities. On October the 13th, 2010, they would not land, they would not communicate with us, and then they would continue this process.
Hold on, Stan, we have to take a break. And we'll be right back, though, and I want to follow that up. About the sighting over New York on that date, the date you just mentioned. Now, some people say it's balloons, but I want to hear your answer and your ideas. Stan Fulham is our guest. Challenges of Change is the name of the book. I'm Jerry Pippin.
Go beyond the obvious and make Roswell, New Mexico, your brave new destination for fun and intrigue. Learn the truth about Roswell's history and see why Roswell's the mother of extraterrestrial connections. Whether you're looking for UFOs and aliens, cultural attractions, outdoor recreation, or even chewy mozzarella, there's plenty to uncover about this uncommon Roswell, New Mexico place. To find out more information on the mysteries of Roswell, visit www.roswellmysteries.com. Roswell, New Mexico. Visitors, welcome.